Norm's Conceptual Corner.
Welcome to this episode of Norm's Conceptual Corner. I am Norm, Norm Schultz, here with my Mile High Sanity Project cohorts, Nick Arcus.
Hello, everyone.
And Chal Moran.
Hello.
And today's topic is natural law.
Naturally.
So, absolutely. You knew I was going to say that. Natural law is both a very old theory, moral theory, and a modern moral theory. It's a very old moral theory in that it really has its roots in St. Thomas Aquinas, who, of course, is to a large degree an Aristotelian. So you could say it has its roots back to Aristotle. I personally don't think that Aristotle would condone this as a moral theory. He wrote repeatedly that he was not in the business of making any moral theories. He didn't think that you could successfully do that. But people seem to take his ideas and disobey that part of them. Of course, this is a religious moral theory. It is not the same as divine command. The Catholic Church does not favor divine command. So this is the moral theory of the Catholic Church. So in that it is, there are a lot of people that believe the reasoning that is here, either implicitly because they follow the rules of the Church, or explicitly because they've looked into these ideas. So a well-represented moral theory. I wouldn't say it's popular amongst people that study ethics, philosophers. But, of course, I went to a secular school. I imagine if you went to a Catholic university, it would be a hot topic. And there are, I'm sure there are a fair number of supporters. I wouldn't say it's a high percentage in amongst ethicists, but it's, a robust moral theory. And just to give kind of an overview today, I want to talk about two different versions of the theory. And mostly I want to talk about kind of the conceptual underpinnings of the theory. I'm not going to emphasize specific moral rules that it talks about, maybe a few. But actually, as a moral theory, this is, I think, best thought of as a kind of a conceptual framework, because the Catholic Church, they change their mind over time. They believe in, the kind of growing, quote-unquote, truth that comes from the Holy Spirit, that they're open to reinterpreting their rules and changing things. They might be slow, but they have done that over the course of time. So I don't think it's wise to approach talking about this moral theory as a strict set of rules. I think it's best to talk about it from, again, a conceptual framework, a very general outlook on the world. So with that, I do want to note that we're also referring to an essay that was written by a philosopher. His name is C. Harris. He's a professor out of Texas A&M. And he wrote a paper that appears in the book Conduct and Character, Readings in Moral Theory, edited by Mark Timmons. And this is the essay on the ethics of natural law. And I think Harris does a pretty good job of representing the overall idea and these conceptual frameworks that underpin it. So I think it's a pretty good way of understanding the general thinking. So, okay, just a quick breakdown. As a moral theory, natural law would, in a very broad, general, broad strokes, would say that what is good, right, all moral theories define the word good, it would say that what is good is roughly what is natural. And so if something is considered to be unnatural, that's a reason for it to be morally wrong. But of course, that rapidly leads to the question, well, what is natural? Which is a difficult question to answer. It's not readily available, what is natural, right? We're not talking about your granola, is it all natural, or does it have M&M's in it? We're not talking about that.
Well, M&M's are natural.
Are they?
Yeah.
Oh, crap. I gotta revise my view of this. So, you know, I mean, the word is thrown around in a lot of different contexts, and it's not exactly, it's not, you know, readily apparent what it means. So we have to figure out, okay, what do we mean natural? And you, more so than just doing that in a general way, what's better to do is, since we're talking about a moral theory, that has to do with what is natural for human beings. So that's really what is at issue conceptually here. What is considered to be natural for human beings?
It seems like there would be some immediate, I don't know, criticisms of this end.
Like what?
What is natural? I mean, if natural is good, like, wouldn't you immediately start thinking of things like, is medicine natural?
Right.
Is medicine immoral?
Yeah. Well, those are good worries, and we're going to talk about that. Yeah. But, you know, for now, let's put on the hat of indulging the theory so that we can try to understand it. And then we'll save our criticisms maybe for later. Maybe that's a good way of approaching understanding these moral theories. So, okay. In pretty early on in Harris's essay, he has a, in fact, his second heading is, that heading is Human Nature and Natural Inclinations. And so this is where he talks about exactly that issue, what is natural for human beings. And what I think is interesting, in the first three paragraphs, he talks about some things, he talks about human purpose and function. And then in the fourth paragraph, and these paragraphs, these first three paragraphs in this section are not very long. In the fourth paragraph, he says this, after saying a few things about what is considered to be natural for human beings. He says, fortunately, we can take another more promising approach. Well, it's really easy to skip over that and not think about what just happened. So when he does that, that's basically a way of saying, you know, all that other stuff in those previous paragraphs, forget all that. That didn't work out very well. And so I want to talk about what happened in those three paragraphs and why he says, fortunately, we can take a more promising approach. Because there is a way of looking at natural law, and it's very hard to say whether people actually lived according to this idea. My guess, not being a history expert, my guess would be that through the course of Christianity from St. Thomas Aquinas till modern times, that there have been and probably still are plenty of people that do live according to these ideas. But that was just speculation. So what idea did he kind of gloss over and say, forget that? Well, it's the idea that human beings have a purpose. And here's how this works. And this does go back to Aristotle. Aristotle talked about how to understand the world. And basically, Aristotle said that, well, if you want to understand the world, you've got to understand objects, or what he referred to as particulars. Because the world is full of objects. That's what makes up the world. And so, you know, if you want to get to know the world, we'll start with an object and understand that object, and then move on to the next object. And eventually you'll understand the world. And he was interested in doing that, right? He cataloged animals by genus and species and talked about concepts in terms of genus and species. So he was very interested in the lengthy, laborious process of ordering things into where they fit in with other things.
Is he the one who kind of invented, like, the scientific method, almost?
Well, I mean, I think that it's difficult to say that. I call Aristotle the first scientist, in a way, though I'm sure that people would differ with me on that. You know, he certainly is mixing philosophy and science,
yeah,
and doing, I think, pure science, even though he got some things wrong. So, for example, one of the things that he proposed as an explanation for why he thought that women were not as smart as men was that women had smaller brains than men. So, now that's obviously, you know, a ridiculous thing to say, but for his time period, that's doing science, right? That's making a scientific statement. It's making an empirical statement.
Right.
It's not clear whether he actually measured anybody's heads, but, you know, at least he's making an assertion that is a empirical kind of assertion. And, you know, some of the things that he makes those empirical assertions about are still right to this day. So some of the species that he divided up of animals, we still use his classification today. So, you know, very smart guy. And yeah, I would consider him to be kind of a philosopher and scientist. So, okay, You're looking at objects, trying to understand them. The way I like to think about this is that, you know, if all you had was a purely physical description of an object, even if you had the object right in front of you, and therefore you could use all of your senses to analyze that object, that alone is not going to help you, not going to get you to the point of understanding what that thing is. So, you know, on radio this is a little hard, but right now I'm holding a little Velcro tie that we use to keep track of our cords here in the quote-unquote studio. If I were to take this and bring it to, oh, I don't know, some tribe in Africa, and they were, you know, playing with it here. If you can hear the Velcro sound, there you go.
Thank you, NASA.
So they're playing with it. They look at it. They could, you know, they can use all their five senses with this, right? They'll taste it. It won't taste like anything. I don't think. I'm not going to taste this. They'll hear what it sounds like. Oh, okay. What does it smell like? It smells like beer somehow.
I think it might be your fingers.
Could be. Could be. You know, after going through that process, they wouldn't understand what this is, right?
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of Descartes when he was talking about the wax. I don't know if you recall that. I think it was in his fourth meditation, third or fourth.
Yeah.
He talks about how he has a piece of wax that you would use to seal a letter, and it starts as a sort of rectangular, rough to the touch, has a definite shape, has a definite scent, and then he lights it on fire. Or not lights it on fire, but melts the wax, and it
brings it closer to the fire and melts it.
It loses its shape, it loses its smell, loses its texture. Basically, every physical property about the wax has changed,
right?
But we still know that it's the same wax,
right?
So it's this kind of thing that the concept of the wax is different from the accumulation of the properties we use to describe it. Is that kind of
that's similar? I think Descartes was trying to prove a different point.
That's
on the same page for sure.
Or I think we're saying that objects aren't just their physical description; it's the concept that underlies it, right?
I'm not even sure. I would say that we're talking about. So we're not talking about metaphysics now. I think we're talking about epistemology.
Yeah.
So we're talking about not the nature of the object, we're talking about understanding the object. And so for Aristotle, yeah, the physical description, and he talked about various classifications of physical descriptions, the physical description is insufficient for understanding that object. But being kind of an empirically minded guy, he was committed to the idea that, you know, the heart of knowing an object is performing some sort of empirical process on that object. It's just that it's not direct. So to augment the immediate information from the senses, this is the way I like to think of it, he came up with the idea of the four causes. So the material, the formal, the efficient, and the final. Okay. And this is a weird notion because of the name. When you think of causes, you think of, well, something causing something else. And he was thinking of the term cause in a much broader term. So, like, the material cause for something would be, for Aristotle, the material that, what is this thing made of? You know, for Velcro, this is made of some sort of plastic, right? So the fact that this Velcro is made out of plastic, well, that is something that I don't directly know from looking at the object, right? I only know because I'm familiar with other things, other plastics. So it's still empirical, it's just not immediately. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah. So he thought, okay, if you know the material cause of an object, well, that's going to help you understand that object. And certainly he's right about that, right? Okay, so the formal cause is a little bit of a weird one. I don't want to spend a lot of time on it. It's difficult for me to describe it precisely. My best description of it is that the formal cause is basically Aristotle asking, what is the thing called, and what does that name mean? So in the case of Velcro, what is it called? Well, okay, it's a proprietary name. What does that mean? Well, I don't know how you'd come up with that. Some names for things are meaningful, right? So if you pick up a pen, okay, it's called a pen. What does that name mean? Well, that's going to tell you something about the object. Right.
Well, I would say we know what Velcro means, though. Even though
we do.
Right.
I mean, like, we do.
If someone says Velcro, you understand.
Right, but it's one of those weird names because it's actually a brand.
It's like Kleenex.
Yeah. So this is probably not actually Velcro. This is probably some cheap imitation. But
you can't even really look at the etymology or anything.
It's there's nothing like that.
Completely out of nowhere.
Yeah, an example of that, or a similar example that I give in my intro classes is the taser. So, you know, now that's become a verb, man, mm-hmm. I got tased. What's funny is that word taser, if you look up the etymology of that word, it's just an acronym that the guy that invented the taser came up with. Yeah. And it's actually an acronym based on some superhero that the guy dug that used electricity or something like that. I forget the name of the superhero. But it's totally, you know, totally idiosyncratic, the name of that. So, you know, the formal cause, well, that's not going to work all the time. It's not going to be that effective all the time. But, I don't know, he still has a point. He still learned something about it. But anyway, I don't want to emphasize that. The direction I want to go is talking about his last two, which would be the efficient and final cause. The efficient cause of an object is an answer to the question, how did the object come to be? How did it come into existence? So it's kind of weird to call it efficient, because with efficient you think, like, you know,
how well it performs.
Yeah, and that's not what he's talking about. He's kind of talking about how does it participate in the stream of cause and effect, as in that effect part. What affected this object coming into existence is another way of putting it. So that we're going to talk about. And then the last cause, the final cause, is what is the thing for? What is its purpose? So, you know, with Velcro, so just to continue and close up this, neaten up this example, tie this loose end, if you give this Velcro to someone who's never seen it before, on top of having the full physical description, you answer those four causes. You tell them what it's made of. You tell them what the word is and what it refers to. You tell them how these things are made and what they're for. After that process, they're going to understand what this is, right?
Mm-hmm.
So Aristotle came up with a pretty good system of understanding objects. So not bad. Well, you could say that Aristotle noticed something in the process. He noticed that there was a correlation between the final cause and the use of the words good and bad. Mm. Okay? So the final cause of an object, that's the purpose of the object, is directly related to our use of the word good or bad, in that if we pick up an object of that type and we try to use it, if it does it effectively, then we call it a good object.
How well it fulfills its purpose.
Exactly.
It's raison d'etre, if you will.
It's what?
It's raison d'etre.
Oh, right. Oh, we're getting Latin here. If it doesn't fulfill its purpose well, then it's a bad object. So, you know, Velcro is maybe not the ideal example. It just happened to be an object sitting around here. But if this didn't stick together, didn't hold stuff together, then, oh, this piece of Velcro is bad. Time to toss it. You know, while it does that, no, this is an effective way of keeping our cords together. It works. Good solution. Okay, so we use words good and bad like that. The example that Aristotle used was that of a knife. You know, you take a knife out of your kitchen drawer, you're trying to cut something, kind of like in the Ginsu knife commercials, trying to cut a nice thin slice of tomatoes or something.
I thought you were going to say like a chew in half or something, or a can.
Yeah, they do cut a can, don't they?
Yeah. Reminds me of the Will It Blend. Have you seen those?
What?
Will It Blend?
No.
Yeah, those are awesome.
Webisodes where this company makes this super blender where they just take random objects and blend them, like iPods and baseballs.
Seriously?
Oh, yeah. And it blends.
Well, yeah, I would imagine.
Very well.
Yeah, unless it's like, you know, titanium steel or something, that's not going to blend very well. You have to melt that.
I don't think I've seen the Will It Blend titanium episode.
No. That's not going to work out very well for them. So, okay, if the object fulfills its purpose, then it is good. And if the object does not fulfill its purpose, then it's bad. And so, hey, I want to check in with you guys. If there were a purpose for human beings, do you guys see that you could make a moral theory out of that?
Yes.
Right.
Yeah, it works, right?
Yeah.
If you could do that. So, it'd be very straightforward. Whatever action you were engaging in, if it was in line with the purpose of being human, then it would be good. If it was not in line with the purpose for a human being, then you would be kind of a bad model of a human being, right? So we'll grant that you can get a moral theory out of this. It's just you have this nasty problem of trying to figure out what the purpose of a human being is. So that's the problem. Aristotle certainly thought there was a purpose, and then that thinking was kind of co-opted for Christian purposes. And then, you know, I would say it changed a little bit over time and also has some of the problems of having to try to bring into coherence some of the biblical passages that deal with an alleged purpose for human beings. So, you know, I mean, it turns into a bit of a clusterfuck. But we can still have a conversation about what the purpose of a human being could be and see if it can work. But before we get to that, with my students, I always like at this point to talk about the purpose of a tree for a couple of reasons. One, it's to draw a distinction between stuff like Velcro and knives and trees and people. And two, I just think it's kind of messed up fun to send my students away with the ability to, you know, respond to someone who asks them, "What did you do in class today?" that they can look them in the eye and say, "I talked about the purpose of a tree in my philosophy class." I just think that's fun. So
you're bringing philosophy down for everyone.
Oh, I am? I'm bringing it up, man. What do you guys think? How would you answer the purpose of a tree?
Well, obviously, it's to provide shade.
Oh, is that obvious? obvious.
No, wait. Firewood.
Firewood?
To make the view more beautiful.
To beautify the earth. To absorb CO2. Mm.
To create fruit.
To create fruit.
To make oxygen.
To make oxygen.
These are all very human-centric. Right. What a strange coincidence.
Maybe we should talk about what's the purpose of a tree from another perspective.
From the
tree?
Or? The independent. From the tree's perspective.
It gives you something to see so you can't see the forest.
Gotcha.
You can't see the forest
from
the tree.
Suck nutrients from your corpse.
You just messed with my head. You just wrecked me. I'm not trying to think like a tree. My answer would be very slow, right? You know, and this gets silly, right?
Yeah.
We'll have Treebeard as a guest.
We'll consult.
To protect the hobbits.
That's right. Oh, no, we went there. I was visualizing that scene in the movie, and I was saying, no, I'm not going to say it. I didn't have to say it. It's not going to be easy to come up with the purpose of a tree. As a matter of fact, I'm going to go ahead and say, and you guys can agree or disagree, but a tree does not have a purpose. There are things that we do with trees. There are things that animals do with trees, right? And, you know, from the perspective of a termite, what are you giggling at? Right?
He's thinking of the Charmin commercial with the bears.
Animals do with trees. Or is your mind in the gutter? Is that what it is? Some horny dog humping a tree.
His bark is worse than his bite.
Yeah. You know, from the perspective of a termite, for example, the tree is just a source of food. I mean, directly, not the fruit or anything, right?
Well, I would say that don't human beings, we create the concept of purpose. So I would say anything doesn't anything not actually have a purpose? We give anything that has purpose? Or is that getting too close to what meaning is?
No, I think you're onto something, but here's the difference. The knife and this Velcro, those are man-made objects.
Right, but they don't count. I mean, that's not what I'm talking about.
Well, of course they count. They're objects.
I guess.
Aristotle, you know, again, if we're going to try to adopt an Aristotelian view for a while, we're going to want to understand what these things are. So, look, if an object is man-made, then this process, I think, works quite well because this object would not exist if someone didn't have a purpose in mind.
Right.
It was designed to fill a slot, so it had that purpose, and without that purpose, then this object is no more.
It's hard to discuss man-made objects without considering the motive for their synthesis.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
there would be no reason for them to be synthesized, right?
I mean, right. And the object wouldn't be in existence, so you wouldn't have it there to talk about. So the nature of the existence of this piece of Velcro is tied up in its purpose.
Right.
And so for that, hey, Aristotle's system works great. But we got to draw a distinction between man-made objects, which, you know, the word for that would be an artifact, and natural objects. And what I think is really interesting at this point is that now you have to start to consider Aristotle's efficient cause. So you got to ask, okay, well, how did natural objects come into existence? And that has a direct bearing on their purpose. You guys following?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, of course, look, it's 2011. Three of us here were interested. We're science-minded people. So that means we believe that the tree, as a natural object, is the result of a process of evolution. And when something is the process, it exists as a result of an evolutionary process, that exactly means that it has no purpose.
Right.
Right. The common sense reason for that is there's no mind driving the process of evolution. So these things, in order for purpose to be kind of in something, well, there would have to be a mind that had some purpose, in mind that led to the creation of that object.
It requires intelligent design, really.
Right. So if something evolved, well, there's no mind in that process. So, of course, there's no purpose. Now, this sounds weird to some people, even science-minded people. There's no purpose to a tree? What do you mean? It fills a role in the ecological system.
I just don't think that people use it the same way philosophers mean it when they talk about purpose then.
Well, and I think...
serves a function.
Right.
Yeah. And
there are reasons for it to... that there are reasons for why it exists.
Well, it depends on your meaning of the word reason. If by reason you mean
evolution,
there's a process that resulted in those, then obviously that's true.
Right, that's what I mean.
But there's not a reason as in, something thought of in advance.
Oh, right, no.
Right. So you got to be careful with these words. So, look, here's what I'm going to say. Most people, even if you're a science-minded person, you have this tendency to kind of anthropomorphize the world. And so you tend to look at objects... in a way that is too human-centered. And so when you look at a tree and you see that it interacts with its environment, you think, well, then this tree has a function or has a role. And the thing is that since the evolutionary process is what brought up the tree, that's actually backwards. It doesn't have a function. It just happened to fill an available slot. Otherwise, it wouldn't be around. So that's kind of the opposite. It's kind of the right. A complete backwards of purpose.
It would be like someone saying, like, the purpose of a tree is to provide shade, right?
Right. It's not.
No.
No, it happens to do that. As a result, we get some shade.
Right. We use it for shade nice. Because it can.
Right. And that's nice. But nature doesn't care if there's shade, so it doesn't have any desires.
Yeah.
Does it make sense?
It does make sense. It kind of, like, leads into, like, I think how certain religious views would look at it. It's like, it's nice that God invented trees so we would have some shade.
Yeah.
And it's nice that he invented giraffes with long necks so they can reach the leaves.
Indeed, indeed. You know what I mean? Only God can make a tree. So look, we're not going to... if God deliberately made trees, like trees... that's the sound of God creating something, by the way.
Nice.
That sounded familiar.
Yeah. if God actually made them, then, of course, there would be a purpose to them, right? Why did he make them? You could ask him in an interview. Here, give him the mic. Hey, why'd you make these? Inquiring minds want to know.
He just wanted to brighten up the landscape. It was really flat, drab without him.
You know what? You kind of sound godlike when you just talk to him.
It's like Bob Ross style. Let's put a happy little tree in here. Where's it live? Right there. There he is.
That's right.
Well, yeah, it's either, he was painting and he tripped.
He just drew the grass really big. It's like,
Or he had a motive.
He happened to have the green on the end of the brush. Yeah. God didn't make trees. The three of us were skeptical of the existence of God anyways. But even if you believe in God, you got your head in your sand if you don't believe that trees are part of the evolutionary process. They were. The evidence is clear. So God didn't deliberately make any of these things. They're part of an evolutionary process. So that means they don't have a purpose. Human beings are on that list as well. So that means that we don't have a purpose. So doors shut on this whole option. Yes, you could get a moral theory out of the idea of human purpose, but since human beings exist as a result of an evolutionary process, then that means that we do not have a purpose. And there's just no cheese at the end of that corridor. It's not going to work out. Here's where I think it's really interesting, and maybe you guys will have fun talking about this. I hope so. But let's play devil's advocate. You should kind of have a segment here, but we're just going to wing it. And let's entertain the idea that, okay, all the other things are part of an evolutionary process, but somehow or other, God created human beings. Now, how to jive that with the evolutionary process? You know, Catholics seem to try to do that. They have a lot of different subtleties, but I would say a view that they hold is that, you know, God wanted to put his spirit or his image in something and saw an organism like us and thought, okay, well, I'm going to give them a soul and they're going to be my project. So, you know, they have a story about that. And, you know, if you're listening to this and are Catholic and know differently, then, you know, please respond to this in our blog and set me straight, because, you know, I don't claim to be an expert on Catholic doctrine. But I think that that's, in broad strokes, what they believe. But let's set all those things aside, and let's just say that somehow religion can resolve this to where God directly made human beings. I still think that you're unsuccessful in getting a purpose. And here's why. I can't think of a good reason for God to make human beings, and I've never heard a good reason. Do you guys have any ideas about what that might be? Just a spitball.
Like, he was lonely. He wanted someone to talk to.
I've always had trouble assigning motivation to the concept of God in general.
Yeah.
Why is that?
Why is he doing anything?
Well, we describe God as things like being perfect.
Yeah.
Lacking nothing.
Yeah.
It seems, how is something moved to act towards any goal or interest?
If you already have everything.
If their nature is complete in and of itself.
Absolutely right.
How can they seek to alter their conditions or circumstances in any way?
Absolutely right. So that's why, you know, if you were to say that God was lonely.
He had all this free space in purgatory and no one to put there. It was a waste of space.
Well, we'll get to that. I'm picky. Whenever you say something, I got to add that to my list. So now that's pending in a serial process of addressing each of these. The lonely one, that one can't work. God, like you said, God is perfect. God can't be lonely. To be lonely means to kind of feel a longing for something that is lacking. If you're perfect, you're not lacking anything by definition. So God can't be lonely.
That's true.
And there's nothing in the Bible that suggests that God was lonely, actually. So that's not a biblical reason for God creating human beings. Silly purgatory one, well, that would just put the question back to, why did God make purgatory? Because it's supposed to be for human beings. So anyway.
Well, God said let there be light, so maybe he just didn't like dark.
We're talking about human beings.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, he created light for us.
People have a lot of different ideas about why God would have created human beings. I've heard some people say that God created human beings because he wanted to see what would happen. And that can't be either, because God is supposed to be omniscient, so he would already know what's going to happen. So he doesn't need to perform any experiments.
Maybe he just did it anyway.
Huh?
Play it all out in his head.
Yeah.
Without even running an
experiment.
That's
right. He would not need to create us.
Maybe we're just all part of God's imagination right now.
Yeah.
The dream of God.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Now, that would be a weird world. But I've had some students say that God created us, you know, to make copies of himself, because God created us in his image, according to the Bible.
And because we're all perfect, that would make sense. So yeah.
There's that big problem. But I think there's also the problem, and I run the risk of offending some students when I start talk about this, but, you know, if a student says that, I tell them, well, look, okay, this is a philosophy class, so that means in a philosophy class, we can talk about ideas in an open way. We don't have to, you know, engage in formalities, etc. So we're not going to just listen to that and go, you know, like we're in a Bible study class and go, yeah, that's cool, yeah. No, we're going to actually critically evaluate it. And so, okay, what would you think about a all-perfect, you know, omnipotent being that made a world just to make copies of himself? I mean, that sounds actually really creepy.
I'd be a great god.
That is a weird idea, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that can't be right. That makes God sound downright narcissistic. Mm-hmm. So that's not a plausible reason. In fact, I don't think the Bible actually supports that reason. It's just, when it says that God made us in his image, that means, you know, I think we have free will like he does.
I'm trying to imagine a reason from the Bible, and I'm having a little trouble.
It just says he just did it. It doesn't really say why he did it.
Well, there are a couple of passages that kind of allude to there being a possible purpose. I would say that in a few places, it seems like the reason why God created human beings is to settle the dispute that Satan rose over God's legitimate authority. Mm-hmm. But that would be probably more a Protestant view than a Catholic view. Again, I'm not sure. If you're a religious person listening to this, please set me straight. But I think that the Protestants emphasize that more, in that Protestants tend to emphasize the severity of human sinfulness,
yeah, you
know, more than Catholics do.
Well, and I have a vague memory of the Bible mentioning the purpose of people is to love God or to worship God.
And, you know, both of those make God sound even creepier, right?
Yeah, very much.
You are an all-powerful, perfect being. You're going to make other beings just so that they can worship you? I mean, that is truly bizarre.
It reminds me of something from Marcus Aurelius in his Meditations. I like things called meditations.
Oh, yeah, apparently.
But, yeah, he said something about what need does something perfect have of praise, of love, of beauty. It makes no sense.
No, it doesn't.
It is what it is, regardless of how you feel about it. And in the same vein, you are what you are, regardless of whether you're praised.
Hmm.
It won't change your actual nature.
Was Marcus Aurelius a believer in God then?
He was a Stoic, so that's kind of a fuzzy question.
Hmm.
Not sort of.
Yeah, I'm not an expert in the Stoics. That's a kind of a gap in my knowledge.
If you look at Stoicism, it's sort of a God is sort of this wishy-washy concept of divine reason, but
sounds familiar.
He's sort of kind of sentient, but sort of kind of the unsentient.
Is it like a precursor to deism almost, or is it not? Is it separate from that?
It's sort of a vague deistic view with the ethical theory being virtuism or virtue. Kind of it's not as refined a philosophy, I would say, but it's certainly very, I don't know, passionate and interesting, but it's not very specific.
Hmm. A passionate Stoic.
Yeah, actually, Marcus Aurelius was a very passionate Stoic.
Crazy.
Probably one of my heroes.
Yeah. Well, okay, so just to recenter here. If you're listening to this and you think that you can come up with a plausible reason for God to make human beings, that's really what we're talking about, right? If you're going to figure out what is the purpose of a human being, indulging the idea that God made them, then you're really asking, why did God make them? And, yeah, I'm with you, Chalmer. I mean, you know, I've read the Bible a number of times. I can't think of a plausible reason, even from it.
Yeah.
There's nothing that I can come up with that works. So what I think is interesting here is that, you know, the three of us, we all know that we weren't created by God. Human beings were made by the evolutionary process. So you don't get purpose from that. Even if you go the God route, it doesn't look like it's at all obvious how to get a purpose for a human being anyway. So, again, there's no cheese at the end of that corridor. It doesn't seem to work out. And I will add one more, and this is, you know, kind of in line of super addition, as in, I think the point has been proven, and now we're going to even prove it more than we need to.
Extra nails for this coffin.
That's right. Even if you overcome the idea of why God made human beings, you still have a problem in figuring out human purpose, and that's because God gave us free will. When you give a being free will, it seems to me that is exactly the act of no longer giving it a purpose. That is what free will is.
If it could choose to have another purpose, what's the point, right?
Right. And so the example I like to give my students is, imagine that you are a robot maker. Okay, you just have this as a hobby. And so you decide one day to set out on a project of making a robot to do your dishes. So the purpose of this robot is dish doing. Okay? Doing dishes sucks. So you're going to build the robot with the right kind of appendages and programming to do dishes. But along the way, before the robot is completed, you give the robot a magic chip that gives that robot free will. When you do that, how in the world can you plausibly be surprised when the robot no longer does your dishes?
Well, that's why you make robot commandments. Thou shalt do thy dishes.
Well, then you should be aware that it's not going to listen, right? I mean, you guys follow me? I mean, that's ridiculous.
Yeah.
So, even even if you were to get by the idea, so we know that God didn't create human beings, we're part of evolution, but even if you believe that God did, I still think you're going to be unsuccessful in coming up with a purpose of human beings, because it's very difficult to figure out how God would make human beings, let alone make anything. And then beyond that, you still have the problem of free will. Look, that's a hopeless project. And I think that that kind of thing is exactly the reason why a guy like Harris writes, fortunately, we can take another more promising approach. That's my point.
Yes.
Right? So, yeah, that doesn't work out very well. But I would say that there are probably still people on the planet that believe that human beings are here for a particular purpose. In fact, I think a lot of Christians, rank and file Christians, believe that.
You always hear people say, like, I think we're here for a reason.
Yeah.
There's a purpose for everything. There's a reason for everything. Yeah. Everything happens for a reason.
Right.
Yeah.
So I do think that people do believe that, and then they kind of, you know, make the connection in their heads, maybe not as deliberately.
In a vague sort of way.
Yeah. So
I think I can see where it comes from. I mean, like all the things that we make for reasons and purposes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Everything that we do, or most things we do for reasons and purposes. So you just think everything must have reasons.
That's right. It's total broad anthropomorphizing.
Yeah.
It comes up a little bit in the argument against the morality of homosexuality. People say, well, that's not natural.
Absolutely. And the Catholic Church has this reasoning as well.
Certainly. And you have to question, you know, my first question in that is, well, why is that relevant? What do you mean natural? Why does that matter if it's natural? Yeah. Et cetera, et cetera. And so it sort of seems when you say, well, that's not natural, you're presupposing that natural has some impact on whether or not something is ethical.
Yeah. And you know, Aristotle, his reasoning made that connection plausible, but it doesn't work. Look, yeah, this is a formal objection to natural law theory in all versions that philosophers raise, that the objection that because something is natural, that being a selling point for it being good seems ridiculous.
Yeah.
You know, okay, there are lots of things that are natural that are clearly not good.
Like hurricanes, those are good.
Yeah, I mean, they refer to those as natural disasters. So natural means it's good? I mean, come on, how could we have a coherent term called natural disasters?
Awesome disasters, more like it.
Awesome disaster! Maybe if you're a storm chaser, but, you know, not for everybody else.
That is kind of funny to have, like, if natural means good and disaster means badness.
Yeah, it's a good disaster.
Right.
Good, bad.
Which, you know, I also think it's a really funny point that a natural disaster for insurance purposes is referred to as an act of God.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, we were talking about this actually before the episode started. So, yeah, okay. But, look, the new version, at least the way Harris talks about it, and, you know, I have a difficult time figuring out if this is actually the way the official Catholic Church reasons or not, for a couple of reasons. One, whenever I look into, you know, the Catholic Encyclopedia or journal articles that are written by Catholic philosophers and I try to answer some of these questions, I frequently find that the material on this is vague and kind of engages in a number of red herrings. So maybe that's because I haven't looked in the right places, but I have not successfully found that this is correct as far as the Catholic Church's thinking is. But I think it's close because Aquinas definitely talks about these four values. And so I'm pretty sure that the Catholic Church still holds that these are in place. They just kind of give a new slant of how you get there. So how you get there, I think, by modern thinking, because the Catholic Church acknowledges the truth of evolution. So, you know, the philosophers that are Catholic philosophers, they're not dumb. They're not going to go down the purpose route anymore because they understand evolution enough to know that's not going to work out. So the way Harris characterizes it is that you don't so much have a definition of what is natural like you would from Aristotelian thinking, where, you know, what is natural is related to what's the thing's purpose. You kind of intuit what is natural by observing the thing. So he talks about observing behavior or ascertaining the natural inclinations of a thing or, determining the goals of the thing just by observing it. So, you know, the example I like to give, which is actually a common example that natural law theorists use, would be, you know, observe a tomato plant. So observe its behavior. You know, look at its goals. Well, what is its behavior? Well, it seems to be engaged in the behavior of making tomatoes. Ascertain its goals. You know, this plant looks like it has the goal of making tomatoes. Ascertain natural inclinations. You know, these plants seem to be naturally inclined toward making tomatoes. So from that, you can determine that what's natural for a tomato plant to make tomatoes. And so you just use that process in looking at human beings. Chalmer, you were looking like you were going to say something.
I was going to say it seems to actually sort of simplify what Aristotle was doing and sort of make it just completely empirical.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of a pro of the method.
Yeah.
If you're going to use a moral theory that determines what is natural, don't have an idea of it having a purpose in mind in advance. Just observe it and see what is natural for that object.
The thing defines itself based on observation.
I have no problem with that.
Sure.
So the way I like to – the analogy I like to give my students is imagine that you are an alien from another planet and you've been sent to Earth as an anthropologist to study human beings. But you're studying them like they're a different species because they are. For you. And so, you know, you're going to use your cloaking device or whatever to just go around and observe human beings in their natural habitat.
Bring your probe.
That's right.
BYOP.
BYOP. Oh, that's terrible. You just wrecked me again. So you're gonna look around at human beings. You're going to look over a long period of time. You're going to study this scientifically. Okay, I get it. And so the question would be, if you were the alien anthropologist, what would you come up with as a description of what is natural for human beings? Okay, so that's a reasonable enough question. I can get behind that project. What natural law theorists think that you will come up with, again, is roughly in line with what St. Thomas Aquinas came up with, which was that you would see that human beings roughly have four values. That a value would just be a different way of talking about their goals or inclinations. And those four values, broadly speaking, are life, procreation, knowledge, and sociability. And, you know, looking at this in real broad strokes with that list, life, procreation, knowledge, and sociability, I don't think that this is sounding completely implausible yet.
Superficially, it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. You look at the human species, there are animals. They're mammals like other animals are. So they have two biological kinds of drives, the drive for living and the drive for procreating. Makes sense?
Mm-hmm.
But they're also kind of unique in that, you know, we have these big brains and tool making and we work together. And so we are interested in knowledge, pursuit of knowledge, and, again, cooperating, being social. So... okay, yeah, again, like you said, superficially, this sounds pretty good. It's where you get into the particulars of this that I have real problems. So actually what I want to do is just read a little bit from what Harris says. Because, I think this represents the thinking of the Catholic Church fairly well. So under life, the way he describes this value is he says, from the natural inclinations that we and all other animals have to preserve our own existence, we can infer that life is good, that we have an obligation to promote our own health, and that we have the right of self-defense. Negatively, this inclination implies that murder and suicide are wrong. So again, before we criticize this, using the value of life can result in there being specific moral rules against murder and suicide. Sounds plausible enough, again, superficially. But I would point out that there is an error going on here. Okay, so you guys tell me if you agree or not. He says that, you know, again, pretending you're the alien anthropologist, you would notice that human beings, like all other animals, have self-preservation instincts. He says from that, you could get that murder is wrong. And that does not make sense to me. Mm-hmm. So predators have self-preservation instincts. If you were to look inside the mind of a predator, would, you know, so I don't know, one of the big cats or a shark or something like that, would you in any way, shape, or form find the idea that, well, life in general is good, and kind of like a happy, hippie kind of hold hands, kumbaya kind of thing.
Except for the gazelle, sure.
Yeah, that gazelle is slipping. Right. And deserves to die.
Those fucking gazelles.
That's right. I hate those.
Kill them all.
Plus they're delicious.
So, yeah, it seems to me that this is an error. If you're going to go this route, I think you do get the idea that suicide is wrong because it's unnatural. And I think that, without trying to encourage too much morbid thinking, if one were to think about, suicide, one of the big problems would be could you actually do it, right? It'd go against your instincts. So I think that using this reasoning, you definitely get an anti-suicide policy, which, by the way, makes sense of the Catholic Church's anti-suicide policy, right? They believe that suicide is a mortal sin, so it's a sin that you can't be forgiven from. This is the reason why.
Well, and it's kind
unnatural.
It kind of brings up for me the idea that this is more empirical. I'm an alien looking at these things, and I'm questioning, what is the nature of this species? But why make that division? Why not the nature of this group or this culture or this society? Or, you know what I mean? Say society is unnatural for human beings on the whole, but to say that society goes against the nature of this individual, if we were to examine the nature of that individual, maybe suicide is completely consistent. What I mean?
It's almost like saying, what is the nature of a psychopathic killer?
Or I would say, can one act against their own nature?
I think you're equivocating on the word nature.
Okay.
And I think that a Catholic philosopher would just say, yeah, we don't mean the word nature in those ways. You can use the word nature in a lot of different ways. So what is the nature of this, bottle? Well, the nature of this bottle is, as a physical object, it's to be at rest. That's not what we're talking about.
We should use that as an example. What is the purpose of beer?
Well, I think it clearly does have a purpose, to taste awesome and to, relax you, get you a little buzzed.
So I guess what I'm looking for is a clarification here.
Can
on
a family dog on this.
What does it mean to say what is the nature of something? The definition of that thing? Sum total of its behavior?
Well, it would have to be from a species standpoint in order for this to work, because, when you start dividing human beings into cultures and groups, then, you would get a form of relativism.
Exactly.
And, that's not kind of what this theory is about. I guess I'd have to think longer as to whether or not that's a real problem for this theory. Maybe it is, Chummer. I don't know. I'd have to think about that. But I think that a supporter of the theory would trip you up on trading in those definitions of the word natural.
Fooey.
From self-preservation instincts, I think it's clear that you get an anti-suicide policy, but it's not clear how you get an anti-murder policy out of that. As a matter of fact, I think that it's perfectly natural. Psychologists talk about this. It's perfectly natural for a human male in certain circumstances to have murderous inclinations. Perfectly natural. We generally think that that doesn't result legally in murder one. That results in, I think, murder two, where that includes the passion and it's not completely premeditated, etc. So we do rank that as important, but as a society, we do not think that a passionate murder is okay because, the person just, they naturally would
do
that.
I'm trying to think back to 6 years ago in your class. Didn't you have an example where you said, males, you can make an argument that from a biological perspective, we have a tendency to be promiscuous?
Absolutely.
With the way the chemicals and bonding, that sort of thing happens.
Absolutely.
That's not allowed, though.
Was that when I was talking about oxytocin?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
It's kind of like saying, we all feel like killing people, just some of us are lazy.
just to tie up that loose end, Chalmer, do you know about oxytocin? Oxytocin is a really interesting hormone.
A little bit, yeah.
Well, okay, so oxytocin is nicknamed the cuddle drug. It's released in the human body, as a way of bonding. So, for example, it's a synthetic form of oxytocin is used to induce labor, because it has the kind of Pavlovian effect. It's released after a child is born with the obvious purpose of getting its mother and child, the mother and child to bond, especially on the mother's part. And so as a consequence of that, if you give a pregnant woman oxytocin, she starts to go into more labor. So it's used to induce labor. Yeah, it's the whole Pavlov thing. Yeah. But what's interesting about oxytocin is it's also released, non-surprisingly, after sex. And it's a way of bonding. And, you know, evolutionary biologists believe that that's because of, you know, the frailty of the human infant. It makes sense that sex would involve bonding because that would make it much more likely for the male to get involved in the care of the offspring, which is going to greatly increase the chances of survival, you know, in the wild, where we evolved all these kinds of emotions. A pregnant mother, and even a mother just holding a baby, is quite vulnerable. So it's going to be really handy to have a strong, virulent, aware, physically, you know, capable male around to protect that. But the problem with oxytocin is that it works on women way better than it works on men because it needs estrogen as a catalyst.
Mm.
So as a result, you get this bonding drug that doesn't affect men very much and affects women a lot more.
Then why do I like to cuddle so much after the fact?
Well, it does have an effect. You know, men have estrogen in their system as well, just not as much. The idea here is that that may be a biological cause for what we refer to as the double standard, because, you know, women have these, you know, obviously this hormone, but also these biological reasons to make a much bigger deal about sex than men. And so that leads to having a moral standard about it, which, you know, look, that moral standard is not good, which is kind of in line with this objection that you were talking about earlier, Chalmer, that because something is natural doesn't make it good. Mm-hmm. Perfectly natural for a society to restrict women's sexual behavior more than men's. Perfectly biologically natural for that to happen because of the way human reproduction works. But, you know, it's not – that's sexist.
Yeah.
So in a modern society, we would not regard that as being morally okay.
Right.
And if there's anything behind that reasoning, then, you know, that would say that what is natural, again, is not good automatically.
Well, they even limit sex in general in any society. Naturally, evolutionarily, it makes some kind of sense.
Absolutely.
But that doesn't seem to have any ethical implications. It seems to be totally based on the sort of, the way our species behaves, the way we procreate, the kind of diseases we're susceptible to, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, I would say in a post-contraception world,
yeah,
none of this makes any sense. Before contraception, well, of course, contraception has been around for centuries in various ways. But, you know, before good contraception, available contraception, before that, it makes sense to restrict sexuality. After that, it doesn't make much sense.
Mm-hmm. Well, and evolutionarily, we haven't adapted to behave in a post-contraception world. We still behave biologically, psychologically, as if we're in a pre-contraception world.
I mean, when was the pill invented? What, in the 40s? 50s?
Might have been after that.
Was it after that? Was it in the 60s?
Well, I mean, you hear about it a lot from the 60s. I don't know when it was first being developed, though.
I think it was it's got to be the 50s. Mm. Yeah, I don't know. Anyway. I do want to talk about a few more of these values. Let me just read one more section, and then I'll make a formal objection out of this. He talks about procreation, knowledge, and sociability. Sociability, this last one, I think is a really good one to look at. That shows just a basic flaw in this idea. So under sociability, Harris mentions, here's what he says. He says, from the natural tendency that we have to form bonds of affection and love with other human beings and to form groups or societies, we can infer that friendship and love are good and that the state is a natural institution and therefore good. And look, this is one of those kinds of statements that if you just read it casually, you won't figure out what was wrong with this. So if you look at this more critically, here's what I have to say about that. Okay, he just said that, you know, implicit in this is that you're an alien anthropologist, and you've looked at the human species in a lot of wide varieties of ways across long spans of time. Okay, and what you've concluded is that human beings naturally have the tendency to form bonds of affection and love with other human beings? Are you kidding me? What in the world have you been looking at? That's my response. Again, you can read over this without a critical eye and just, oh yeah, warm fuzzy feeling, but come on. all the wars and terrible things that we do to each other, that's a big part of human life. How come that's not in here?
Seems to have a lot more to do with proximity.
What do you mean?
Oh, well, we tend to form closer attachments to the people we're stuck around than the people on our land.
Yeah.
Or the land we decide is ours.
Even then.
Yeah.
It doesn't, you know, so, you know, look at what's obviously going on with the Israelis and Palestinians.
Yeah.
They live in very close proximity. I mean, you know, in different parts of the same cities. And, yeah, they hate each other.
Yeah, I think you make the argument that we're a hostile species. Not totally hostile. I mean, we certainly do have the tendency to form lasting, loving relationships.
But yes.
Certainly not one of our defining basic characteristics any more or less than the fact that we're also hostile and we tend to beat the shit out of each other.
Yeah, we surely do. I mean, yeah, there's no course of human history that shows long periods of peace.
I think we'll talk more about this sort of thing whenever we get talking about state of nature during social contract stuff, but it makes sense, I think. In a state of nature, it makes sense to be more nasty and brutish if that's what life is like.
Yeah. Well, and so, look, I just want to state my formal objection before we, you know, belabor this point too much. The formal objection I would say to this is that this theory has to engage in cherry picking in order for it to work. So what do I mean by that? Well, you know, so cherry picking, obviously, that's just picking out what you want and leaving what you don't want, even though your criteria says that you should take it all. And I would say that if you are an alien anthropologist looking at the human species and what is natural, you're going to see some nice things. You're going to see some good things. But you're also going to see some terrible things. It seems perfectly natural for human beings to be petty, to be jealous of others, to be vindictive when we feel wronged, to be overly sensitive, to have an excessive sense of pride. I mean, the list is on and on of things that we do that are seem perfectly natural that we have to fight very hard to overcome for the reason of them being natural, and they're not remotely good. And somehow or other, they don't appear in natural law literature as a reference of what is good. You guys following me?
Yeah.
So that somehow mysteriously got left out. One of the examples I like to give my students, which I just think this is hilarious, is this German word that has started to become incorporated into the English lexicon, Schadenfreude.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It's a great freaking word.
One of my favorites.
If you're listening and you don't know the definition of that word, totally a Googleable term, though I'm not going to be able to help you out with the spelling of that. You're on your own.
Pleasure at your enemy's defeat.
That's right. Or the joy you feel when someone else fails. Mm-hmm. Yep. That seems to me like a perfectly natural human reaction.
It is. Every time Ohio State beats Michigan, I feel it.
Or when Bush said, "Is our children learning?"
Well, think about the amount of time that is dedicated on the news networks to a celebrity that falls from grace, like the whole Tiger Woods scandal.
People enjoy it. Magazines. I mean,
it's almost a sick pleasure. Yeah, it's mesmerizing. Or, you know, in a casual way, this is an example I always like to give. Let's say you're driving down the highway, and you see someone else get pulled over. You know, it's like.
You mean to go, ha ha.
Yeah.
It's a Simpsons reaction.
That's right. Right. So, look, this seems to be a perfectly natural human reaction, but somehow it doesn't show up in these lists. Mm-hmm. So, okay, that's the formal objection. If you were going to do this, you could come up with a kind of picture, a finely palleted picture of what is natural for human beings, and there's no way in hell that would be a good source of what is good. Plenty of things that we do that are natural that are not good. So, you know, it seems to me that in order to get this moral system to work, you have to engage in what philosophers call casuistry, which is where you set it up to give you the answer that you want. So, yeah, for that reason, you know, I think that it's safe to reject this moral theory as a guide. And, you know, that rejecting this moral theory, that's not going to go over very big with any Catholic that is listening to this, because this is their moral theory. And I just would challenge any Catholic on this issue to try to resolve these issues. I don't think they can be. I won't go so far as to say that they can't be. I'll leave it open. But I don't see how they can be. It doesn't make sense to me that you could resolve this problem. Do we want to talk about the principle of double effect? Or the what I think I prefer the name the doctrine of double effect because I like DDE. It's a fun acronym.
PDE?
Instead of PDE, yeah. PDE. That sounds wrong somehow. Well, look, the doctrine of double effect is a addition to the to natural law theory. But, you know, it's not exclusive to natural law theorists. So Kantians sometimes talk about the doctrine of double effect, and sometimes philosophers will talk about the doctrine of double effect just independently. It's actually kind of a neat four-part criteria. Here's what this is: the doctrine of double effect is about. When you have a system like natural law that has multiple values, two things. One, you have to recognize that sometimes you're going to get in a situation where there's a conflict in values, where something you're doing minimizes or detracts from one value but maximizes another. But the second thing, and the reason why it's called the doctrine of double effect, is the realization that most human actions have more than one result. They result in multiple things happening, right? The cascading effects of what we do. And so how do you look at these things morally speaking? If, you know, one of the effects is good and one of the effects is bad, how do you figure that out? And there are lots of examples of this kind of thing that natural law theorists will talk about. So some, for example, some philosophers spent a fair amount of time after World War II talking about what they referred to as obliteration bombing. An example of this would be what happened at Dresden, where the Allied forces firebombed a town that was populated with a lot of civilians. And, you know, some of the fires that we caused were so intense that people were, you know, basically evaporated while they were alive. And we're talking about a lot of casualties. You know, the kind of stuff that happens in war, it brings up interesting moral problems. You know, if you're, let's say you're engaged in a just war, which, you know, fighting the Nazis, I think, is a pretty damn good example of a just war. Let's grant that it is. Well, does that mean you're allowed to do anything? Well, no, there has to be some moral rules or limits. And so it makes up for some interesting questions. In the case of the bombing at Dresden, the interesting question was, okay, it had an effect on the war. It had a positive effect on the total war, but the cost was you killed a lot of civilians in a terrible way. Is that justified?
It's a question of a victory by any means.
Right.
Surely the atomic bomb has to be like the ultimate version of this, right?
Yeah, though I personally have different feelings about that than something like what happened at Dresden. The Japanese people were an unusually unified people where everyone was ready to take up arms. I'll grant that. You had situations where teenage girls would bring grenades to school in case the Americans landed in their town. And they were kind of trained to, you know, gather up their friends and, you know, grenade themselves to death and try to take some soldiers with them and things like that. So, you know, I mean, there's an unusually unified culture. So I think, you know, for those circumstances, that's a messy example.
Kind of the Shintoistic religion.
Yeah, that's true.
Was sort of pretty pervasive throughout the entire culture.
And the way they viewed the emperor.
Yeah,
very kind of a pseudo-religious figure, yeah. Mm-hmm. So, but, you know, I don't want to talk about the Dresden example too much. Just in general, the doctrine of double effect comes to bear when, you know, you have a dilemma, when you're not sure what is morally right because something about what you're doing also causes something bad to happen. Another example would be, from the Catholic Church's standpoint, the use of condoms to stop the spread of AIDS. They are against contraception because it's unnatural, right? That does not jive with the natural inclination toward procreation, in their view. So artificial contraception is immoral. As a side note, I think that there's something weird about that. So apparently, and again, I'll repeat, if there's a Catholic listening to this and I got this wrong, please correct me. But it's my understanding that the Catholic's view on this is that natural forms of contraception are okay, Which about the only two methods of natural contraception that I can think of would be the rhythm method and the pull-out method.
Or you could just be pregnant.
Well, that would not be contraception, Nick.
You could get pregnant again while you're pregnant.
Oh, I see your point. Well, sex while pregnant, I'm sure they'd be okay with that. I don't know, would they? That's weird. Anyway, I'll set this aside. The rhythm method. Do you guys know about the rhythm method? You haven't heard of this? You didn't take sex ed?
I didn't, actually.
Seriously?
Yeah, I never had sex ed.
The rhythm, here's the rhythm method. If you have sex with a woman, you know, the most fertile time is basically the opposite time of the 28-day cycle, right? So 14 days after her period, roughly, that's like the peak of ovulation, about, right? So the closer you have sex to that, the more likely she is to get pregnant. The further away from that, then the less likely she is to get pregnant. So if you have sex with a woman that you're having sex with her pretty close to the time of her period, then she's less likely to get pregnant. That's the rhythm method.
Okay.
And just to be clear, that is not an effective method of contraception.
Yeah, don't try this at home, kids.
Yes, don't try this at home, unless you want to get pregnant. And the reason for that is complicated. The way I like to put it is it's a reference to Jurassic Park, Life Finds a Way.
Right.
Women have been – I mean, there are cases of women ovulating late or ovulating early for various reasons. There's actually some reason to believe that if a person – if a couple were to engage in the rhythm method for a long period of time, the body might kind of pseudo-intentionally mess with the time of ovulation so that she would get pregnant.
In periods of stress, they might stop ovulating.
Sure.
It's really not very rhythmic.
No, it's not. It's not like, you know, clockwork. And the other thing, the other variable is it's not entirely clear how long sperm can live once they're in a nice, warm, cozy place. So, as opposed to, you know,
a napkin.
Right, the tissue. So, yeah, so that's not a good method. The pull-out method, just to be a little fatherly to anybody that's listening, the pull-out method is not a good method of contraception because, newsflash, males have what is referred to as pre-ejaculate. That means their penis, when erect, will lubricate itself with sperm in getting ready for the main march of sperm, and a woman can get pregnant from the pre-ejaculate. So
the main march.
That's right, the main march. It's just like, you know, the beginning of the parade where there's a little, and then there's the big one.
There's the vanguard that comes first.
And that's right, it's the vanguard.
I just keep picturing someone pulling out and saying, "Oh God, amen."
Oh boy. And then, you know, threw the hole in the sheet. But look, that's not going to work. Women have gotten pregnant so just to be clear, a woman can get pregnant before the man ejaculates. Without the man ejaculating at all, that sounds weird, but it's possible because of pre-ejaculate. So
natural contraception, it's all a ruse.
That's right. It's not going to work. Okay, so that ends this version of sex ed. So you know, the Catholic Church does not believe in artificial contraception. Under the doctrine of double effect, even using contraception for something noble, like stopping the spread of AIDS, violates the doctrine of double effect, because one of its rules is, and this is one of the things that I think is a key part of the doctrine of double effect, has these four rules. The first is the intrinsic rule, which is that the way you decide, one criteria is the act outside of the consequences a good act? Okay. The second one would be the unavoidability rule, what I call the unavoidability rule, which is, can you get the good effect without the bad effect by doing it a different way? I think that's a no-brainer. If you can get the same good effect without a bad effect, then that's obviously morally better. So I have no problem with that. The third one is intriguing, though. I call it the side effect rule, which, according to the doctrine of double effect, you can do something that is good if that goodness results in something bad, as long as the last rule is not violated, which is the proportionality rule. So as long as the bad and good that are your results are roughly equal, doing something good and that resulting in something bad is permissible. But doing something bad for the purpose of ultimately getting something good out of it is not permissible. Mm-hmm. So in the case of using condoms to stop the spread of AIDS, that's the reason why the Catholic Church does not allow that. It's because you're doing something bad, you're using artificial contraception to try to get something good, which is to stop the spread of AIDS. So, you know, look, that's how – two things. One, that's how the doctrine of double effect works. But secondly, this is a extremely controversial policy of the Catholic churches that, you know, they get flack for all the time. And they have so – they've gotten so much flack for this that the Pope last year – did you guys know about this? That last year he gave a talk where he talked about the use of condoms. And I think the context where he was talking about this – if I'm not mistaken, was he was kind of referring to someone going down a path of repentance. He gave, I think, the example of a male prostitute. And let's say that male prostitute started to use condoms because he wanted to stop the spread of AIDS. And the Pope said that that would be along the path of redemption or a path of becoming a morally better person. And so people thought, oh, is the Catholic Church changing their policy about condom use? And so actually I occasionally since then have gotten students that have thought, well, the Catholic Church isn't against condom use anymore. No, it's not true. They're still against condom use. So they clarified this later. And they just said, well, no, what you're taking the Pope out of context. He was just talking about doing something that's better. It's still not morally permissible. So that's an obviously controversial topic for Catholics. And it definitely has an effect in a country like Africa where the Catholic Church has charities. And they, you know, distribute – they don't distribute condoms. They tell people not to use them. And, you know, what their official doctrine would be, well, they encourage abstinence. And if you're abstinent and you have AIDS, then you don't spread it. And my response to that is, yeah, how's that working out? It's not working out very well.
No.
So, I mean, you know, you could say just, you know, objectively looking at it, a lot of Catholic charities in Africa are just manufacturing plants for AIDS. That's all they are. I mean, people come in, they have AIDS, they're starving and poor. The Catholic Church feeds them, gives them some health care.
Promotes procreation,
right. Tells them not to use condoms, sends them out to spread AIDS. It's terrible.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Millions of people suffering.
Yeah. So, look, that's an explanation of how the doctrine of double effect works. And I guess we could call this episode like, you know, Norm's Conceptual Corner, Natural Law, colon, or how to know a Catholic, right. Something like that. Inside the mind of a Catholic, who knows?
Or be mad at the Catholic Church.
Yeah. But that's the thinking, and that's, I think, a way for people to understand their policies a little more. But look, I think it's pretty clear that if you look at this objectively or neutrally, these policies are bad policies, and that this moral theory doesn't actually add up.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I would say that we have to keep looking.
Another one bites the dust.
Yep.
Damn. Keep showing up, hoping I'll walk away with something.
Wah, wah, wah. Well, thanks for joining me, guys.
Thanks for
having us.
Yeah.
Sweet.